Good morning, church. Such a blessing to be with you guys today. I get the privilege of preaching from one of my all-time favorite stories and moments in Scripture. I want to begin by sharing some numbers with you that I think are very interesting. So, just for a little bit of context, about 20, 25 years ago, there was this movement known as the New Atheists on the rise. So people like Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, very militant, very aggressive in their belief that there is no God, trying to convince people of this fact, so writing books on the topic, debating religious leaders. They were famous for going so far as to say that religion has been bad for society. I share that with you because that movement gave people the impression that in our society, there are those who have religious affiliation, those who do not, and a wide chasm between them in which there is no similarity. The numbers I'm going to share with you this morning paint a much different story. So this is from a study done in 2024 by the Pew Research Center. Here's what they found. First thing is this: 28% of Americans are considered religious nuns. Now, I put the spelling on the screen because the spelling matters a great deal here. I'm not talking about N-U-N nuns. This is a different type of nun altogether. This nun refers to anybody who does not have a religious affiliation. So pretty wide range of people. That could apply to somebody who is an atheist and says, I don't believe in God. That could apply to someone who's agnostic and says, oh, there might be a God, there might not be. That could even apply to somebody who claims to believe in a higher power. So it's when they started taking a deeper look at this group that things got very interesting. So 28% of Americans, that's a little under 100 million people, okay? So of that 100 million people, only 29% of them reject the existence of a higher power. So less than a third of them in that religious nuns group who say, I am certain in my belief that there is no God. So what about the rest of them? Well, this last statistic is very interesting to me, okay? So of those 100 million people, right, who identify as religious nuns, 49% of them say that spirituality is important to them. That is fascinating to me. That's a lot more than there might be a God, there might not be. That actually expresses a belief in a higher power and even a desire to connect with that higher power. I think more and more in our society, there is kind of an attitude of curiosity whenever it comes to the unknown. So the question is, actually, could you keep those statistics back up there on the screen? The question is, why do those 50% of religious nuns who say that spirituality is important to them, why don't they have a religious affiliation? There's probably a number of good reasons for this. I think one of the reasons, though, is for a lot of people, curiosity is a little bit more appealing. I think a lot of people have a great deal of hesitancy about saying anything with certain about who God is. In other words, I think there's a lot of people in our society who are seeking after an unknown God, something that feels as though it is there, but remains just unknown to them. And so they'd rather stay in this space of just complete openness. Yes, I'm open-minded. I just don't want to plant my flag in the ground. I share these statistics for two reasons. One, just to paint a picture, like I said, of the way our society seems to be made up today. The other reason is this: before we maybe rush to judgment on this group, these religious nuns who do not have, who say that spirituality is important to them, I think maybe we can relate to this group to some degree. Whether we would admit it or not, whether we've ever said it to another person, I think maybe all of us have wondered at some point in our life, can the God of the universe actually be known? What can I actually know about God? Like maybe you were certain at one point in your life and then something tragic happened that made you wonder, am I also seeking after an unknown God? And so our story today comes from Acts chapter 17. Paul is going to find himself in a city whose culture bears some remarkable similarities to ours whenever it comes to this curiosity. What's funny about this story, Paul ends up in the city of Athens kind of by accident. So he's going about his missionary journeys, and he keeps going to cities, preaching the gospel, encountering a very hostile reaction, and then having to flee for his life. Okay? And so it's on one of these most recent runs for his life that he ends up in the city of Athens. But in the city of Athens, he's going to experience a much different reaction whenever he preaches the gospel. So we're going to be in Acts chapter 17, starting in verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. Some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities, because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection." We need to pause here and kind of take stock of these two groups that Acts has just thrown at us, these Epicureans and these Stoics. I don't know about you, I've never encountered a practicing Epicurean or Stoic in my life. So we don't have time to do kind of a full catalog of what these two groups did and didn't believe and comparing them to one another. But what I want to do is I want to share three core foundational beliefs that these two groups share. And these beliefs are helpful because I think they help paint a picture of how the Epicureans and the Stoics and the Athenians at large, the framework through which they viewed the world. So here are three beliefs that Epicureans and Stoics shared. The first one is this. Both groups believed that there was a realm not felt by human senses. So in other words, they looked at the world around them and they reasoned, okay, I can touch this stand in front of me, I can touch my own hand, but certainly there's more to the universe than just that. There's more than just can what be seen and tasted and touched by human senses. There is another realm that exists beyond what we can naturally observe. Second thing that both groups believed is this, that the gods were impersonal and couldn't be known. So both affirmed the existence of some sort of gods, but both believed that these gods had little to no concern for what humans did with their lives, how they interacted with one another. And further, they believed that you couldn't really assert anything definitively about what these gods were like. You couldn't name an attribute and say with certainty whether these gods did or didn't have that attribute. And the last thing is that both believe that there is no afterlife or resurrection. So hopefully you're seeing the comparison that I'm drawing between our culture today and the Athenian culture in that overwhelmingly there is this belief that, yeah, what we can see and taste and touch, that's not all there is. Many people, even outside of our faith, agree with us on that. But then there's this hesitancy about saying anything with certainty about what that higher power might be like. Let's keep reading in verse 19. They took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. Important to note that at this time, Athens is more or less the intellectual capital of the world. This is where people go and travel to share and hear the latest and greatest in human thought. And in the city of Athens, curiosity is kind of a requirement. Like we see that in the way that people react to Paul. Yeah, some people lightly mock him, calling a babbler, but other people actually want to give him a platform to share more about what it is that he's teaching. So they take him to this place called the Areopagus. Now, what is the Areopagus. I think a helpful metaphor for understanding what that is think almost like a TED Talk. So what a TED Talk is they'll set up on a college campus somewhere in the United States. They'll bring in people who are on the leading, cutting edge of whatever field they're in, and they give a 10, 20, 30-minute lecture on the subject. And if you go to a TED Talk, you go with an open mind. Like, you go hoping to learn something new. Okay, that's similar to the way that the Areopagus works. It's the place within the city of Athens where you go to hear the new ideas. And like a TED Talk, you go actually hoping to learn something new. Where it gets interesting is none of the Athenians are expecting to have their entire worldview overhauled. Like, no one is expecting Paul to say something that will fundamentally change the way that they view the world. Let's keep reading in verse 22 to see how Paul handles this platform he's been given. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.'" I think this is the most remarkable part, because Paul is in this city of intellectuals whose thirst for knowledge is insatiable, and they still feel the need to build an altar to an unknown God. There's still this admission that our knowledge is very much incomplete, and we actually kind of like it that way. We'd rather just continue to worship this unknown God. It's like so many in our culture today who are seeking something that certainly feels as though it's there, but that remains just unknown to them. Put short, the Athenians don't want to miss something. And I love this speech so much because we're about to see Paul's ministry skills on full display. Because rather than see an obstacle to preach the gospel, Paul actually sees a really great opportunity. Paul sees an opportunity in this city full of people who gather to worship an unknown God. He sees an opportunity to set the record straight on who God is. And so that's exactly what he's about to do. So I'm going to read the rest of this speech in its entirety. And here's what I want you to do as I'm reading. I just want you to make mental notes of any time that Paul says God plus a verb. Anytime Paul says God is, God does, God makes, or he is, he does, he makes, etc., make note of those instances, because Paul is going to make a great many claims about who God is. Let's read on, starting in verse 23. "What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods in the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God, perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead." In this cultural moment that is so similar to ours, of all the things that Paul could have said, Paul chooses to say this. He chooses to give a speech that says, "People of Athens, you may worship an unknown God, but I do not." And so first and foremost, the good news for us is if we claim to worship the same God that Paul worshiped, then we do not worship an unknown God. Paul makes it abundantly clear there are things we can know with certainty about who God is and what God is like. And so if you are one of those individuals who I described earlier, who you feel like you're seeking something that remains unknown, let me tell you, you don't have to look any further. Paul gives an account of a God that is known. And if you're someone who's more or less followed God for your entire life, this speech is a reminder and a comfort in those moments of darkness where we wonder, can I actually know God? Paul says, yes, yes, you can. This is a God that you can know well. The Athenians built an altar to an unknown God. Paul makes it clear that there is a God who is known. And so if you did that little exercise that I suggested, like I said, you'll notice that Paul makes a lot of claims about who God is and what God does. And we don't have time to talk about each one of them in depth. But what I want to do is I want to talk about three profound claims that Paul makes about who God is. So according to Paul, the known God is, first and foremost, fully sovereign. Paul says this in verse 24. "The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth." Paul goes on to say that God made every single nation. He kind of ends the speech by saying that God will judge the entire earth. The implication is God has every right to do that because he made the entire earth. The Athenians have this way of viewing the world where certain gods have dominion over certain parts of their lives. So there's a god that has dominion over the sun, a god that has dominion over the moon, and neither of them have dominion over one another. Paul makes it clear that is not the case with this God. This God is Lord of all because he's creator of all. Now, we don't necessarily build altars to many different gods. But we do tend to compartmentalize God as if he could be Lord of our lives only some of the time. Like maybe on Sunday, we're quite sure that he's Lord of our lives. Monday, we're pretty sure that he's Lord of our lives. Tuesday, we're kind of sure. And then by Friday and Saturday, we've forgotten about the whole thing. Paul leaves no room for doubt. This God is Lord of all, creator of all, and has dominion over all. The known God is fully sovereign. But this leads us straight into the next claim that Paul makes, because when I think about a king that is fully sovereign, that has complete control and dominion over their subjects, I imagine a king that's distant. Because why would a king that's fully sovereign be involved in the lives of their subjects? What incentive would they have to do that? And so Paul corrects this misunderstanding because he also asserts that the known God is intimately personal. Verse 27, "that they should seek God, perhaps feel their way toward him and find him, yet he is actually not far from each one of us." I already mentioned that the Epicureans and Stoics, they both believed that the gods were impersonal. They were there, but they didn't care what you did with your life. Certainly didn't care about how humans treated each other. Have you ever had a moment in your life where it's felt as though God made the world, set things in motion, and then stepped away? This speech is a comfort and a reminder that the God we serve, this known God, is not impersonal. He is not distant. In fact, he's so close to the lives of his creation, he actually does care how they treat each other. In verse 31, Paul says that God will judge the world in righteousness. God cares when his created beings treat each other unjustly, and he won't leave injustice unpunished. Paul makes it clear this is a personal God who's near to us, desires for us to know him. And then in verse 24, he makes another claim that's one of my favorites. This God doesn't live in temples made by human hands. No, this is a God that lives in hospital rooms, in funerals, in weddings, in birthday parties, and at work, and at family dinners, and in a breakup. This is a God that is intimately involved in every aspect of the lives of the beings that he has created. This is a God that desires to know and be known by his creation. And then the last claim that we'll talk about, Paul makes about who God is. That is, according to Paul, the known God is in need of nothing, but gives everything. Verse 25. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. Paul makes clear, we need God. God does not need us. Have you ever thought about that? That we're pretty needy? I'm not the biggest fan of that. I don't necessarily like being a needy person. Like if you're talking to somebody who's in a relationship and they say the other person in their relationship is needy, they don't usually mean it as a compliment. This dynamic where we need somebody, they don't need us, it terrifies us. It terrifies us because we know what we do with this dynamic. And we do it even without realizing it. Like, how great is it if you're in a job situation where they need you and you don't necessarily need them? Like, you're a great asset where you work and you have lots of other job offers on the table. You can leverage that into getting a promotion or into getting a raise. More often than not, when somebody needs us and we don't need them, we tend to abuse it. And Paul makes it clear that God exists in this dynamic all the time. From eternity unto eternity, it has been that we need God and God does not need us. So what does God do with this dynamic? Well, rather than abuse it, he willingly chooses to give us everything. And I don't know how to describe this in any way other than this. I look out in the crowd and I don't see a room full of inanimate objects. Like, you are not a rock. You are not the pew that you're sitting on. You are a living being. You have life and breath in your lungs. You have thoughts and feelings and emotions. You feel joy. You feel sadness, heartbreak, happiness. Everything about who you are and what you do is because of this known God. And what's even more incredible is that the giving actually doesn't stop there. This known God, who we need, who does not need us, he so desires that we would spend eternity with him that he gives himself as a sacrifice for us. In the ultimate act of love, a God who needs nothing that we can give him, gives himself so that we can spend eternity with him. A known God that is fully sovereign, intimately personal, in need of nothing, but who gives us everything. And I mean everything in every possible sense of the word. So, here is my hope. Okay? My hope is that nothing that I have shared with you is news to you. My hope is that you already knew everything that I have told you about God this morning. But the reason that I love this speech so much and why it is one of my favorite stories in the Bible is because I know enough about this church to know that in this room, there are people going through everything from the greatest joy of their life to the greatest heartache of their life, and everything in between. And I know that no matter where you are on that spectrum, we can all stand to be reminded of who it is that we serve and worship. Because we do not worship some abstract ideology. We worship a known God. And so the only question that remains for us is this: what will our response be? Let's read the final three verses of this story, see how the Athenians responded to Paul's words. Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. Others said, "We'll hear you again about this." So Paul went out from their midst. But some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. So we basically get three responses in this story. Some mock. Some just openly criticize Paul's message. They're just like, yeah, I'm out. This isn't for me. Some, interestingly enough, seem pretty content with just remaining curious. They're content with continuing to seek after an unknown God. They're all good with regular trips to the altar to the unknown God. But then there's a third group. Some choose to follow. Some accept this invite to know God and be known by God. And so if you're listening to this today and you are one of those people who I described at the beginning of this service, someone who is seeking after something that feels unknown, let me tell you that choosing to follow this known God is the greatest decision that you could ever make. And so if that's something that you're interested in, or something you'd like to hear more about, I will be down here once we begin singing in just a few moments to tell you more about that. But as for the rest of us, I think only one proper response remains in light of this speech, in light of being reminded about this known God who we serve, and that is to worship. And so that's exactly what we're going to do. If you need prayer this morning, we'll have shepherds at the back of the room. They would be more than happy to pray with you. But please stand with me and lift praises to the known God.